Whitaker Chambers and Elizabeth Bentley shocked America in 1948 with their allegations that communist spies had penetrated the American government. The resulting perjury trial of Alger Hiss is legendary, but Chambers and Bentley also named Harry Dexter White, a high-ranking Treasury Department official. White defended himself before Congress, but he died only 1 week later, lending much speculation about the cause of his death and the truth of the charges against him. Now armed with a wealth of new information concerning the case, our guest this week, Bruce Craig, has examined this controversial case and explored the ambiguities that have haunted it for more than a half a century. Bruce Craig is Executive Director of the National Coalition for History and the author of Treasonable Doubt, The Harry Dexter White Spy Case. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you, Brian.
Okay, who's Whitaker Chambers?
Well, in order to sort of find out and understand Whitaker Chambers, I think we need to go back into the 1930s very briefly in terms of setting the time frame. The 1930s was a time of tyrants. It was a time of plots, of conspiracies, of assassinations, and of secret agents. It was also a time of mixed loyalties and moral dilemmas. People like Whitaker Chambers, who was an underground courier for the Soviets in the 1930s until his defection in 1938, had a certain amount of this mixed loyalties. And Chambers is perhaps best remembered because of his shocking allegation that spies, people like Alger Hiss, indeed had penetrated the American government.
Okay. Tell us about Elizabeth Bentley. Who was she?
Elizabeth Bentley, like Whitaker Chambers, was a Soviet courier. She was the key contact in a Washington, D.C. spy group that operated during World War II. Her key contact was a man named Nathan Gregory Silvermaster, one of the few Americans in the KGB Hall of Fame who has their picture there. Bentley is particularly important because it was her group of underground spies who collected information about Soviet espionage, about the American government, and was transferred to the Soviets during World War II. We know that many of the documents that these individuals turned over indeed were damaging to the United States, and they've been documented in a group of documents that have recently come forward known as the Venona documents.
Why were so many people in the 30s, and we're talking about really what we would call the best and the brightest of their New Deal generation, interested in communism?
Well, again, we have to sort of bring ourselves back into the 1930s. And if you recall, during the early 30s, we were dealing with the Great Depression. There were inherent weaknesses in the capitalist system. And as a result, many Americans were intrigued by the communist experiment that was going forward in Soviet Russia. The romance of communism did appeal to a certain type of person who indeed envisioned a great day coming, a new world in which workers, ordinary people, would have new powers. The other thing that impacted people in the New Deal generation was the fight against fascism. And for people like Harry Dexter White, like Nathan Gregory Silvermaster, I think it was the fight against fascism that was the key attraction for them.
Okay, good point. Your book is one of, obviously, a library shelves full of books on the anti-communist movement, and maybe it'd be best to position your book by talking a little bit about the historiography. What are the major schools of thought on the anti-communist movement?
Well, there are certainly lots of books on the rise of anti-communism. I find at least a very short, very good one is by a renowned historian, Melvin Loeffler, called The Specter of Communism, The U.S. and the Origins of the Cold War. For people who are interested in reading a left perspective, Joel Colville's book, Red Hunting in the Promised Land, Anti-Communism and the Making of America, is good. And for those who want a more conservative perspective, I think Richard Gid Power's book, Not Without Honor, The History of American Anti-Communism, is a good place to start. Now, each of these books, mine included, actually focus on a number of key issues. How real was the communist threat? The role of the Communist Party USA and its independence or lack of independence from Moscow. The importance of Soviet espionage and the broader communist movement in general. And then those specific questions that biographies like mine address, who was and who was not a spy?
Okay. I want to get to Harry Dexter White, but let's just take a moment because they're so prominent in their cases, Hiss and the Rosenbergs. And
right.
What's the latest historiography on their relative guilt or innocence?
Well, because of the evidence in the Venona decrypts, there seems to be little doubt that Julius Rosenberg indeed was one of the atomic spies. The Alger Hiss case, of course, is a more complex story. Actually, I'm working on a biography of Hiss right now. It's going to be my next book. But I must say that the tide seems to have turned, that most scholars, I think, do agree that the Venona decrypts are highly suggestive that Alger Hiss indeed was a Soviet spy.
Okay. Who's Harry Dexter White?
Harry Dexter White was an assistant secretary of Treasury under Henry Morgenthau. He is the highest level official ever accused of espionage in the American government. He is remembered prominently for being the co-founder of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. He grew up in Boston. He was educated in Harvard and Stanford and Columbia, a very progressive thinker, an internationalist, a New Dealer. But I certainly found that he was indeed involved in what I would term at least a species of espionage.
Okay, I want to come back to that one because that's a great phrase. But let me ask you first as we move in that direction, what evidence did Chambers and Bentley have against him?
The evidence that Whitaker Chambers had was a document that came to light during his perjury trial known as the White Memorandum. It's a four-page yellow notepad of information largely relating to Japan. The notes are in Harry Dexter's hand. They are significant. They relate to Japanese policy. So Chambers actually has some physical evidence. Elizabeth Bentley, basically, her testimony is largely uncorroborated. But then we do have some new evidence that came to light in 1996 with the release of the Venona decrypts that shows that Harry Dexter White was, quote, willing to make any self-sacrifice for his beliefs. He feared compromising to the new course if he was discovered. And that memorandum reveals that he was a very, very cautious individual in terms of providing information to the Soviets.
Okay. We've mentioned the Venona papers, as I refer to them, twice already. Mm-hmm. Just give us a sentence or two. What are you referring to?
The Venona decrypts are transmissions between Soviet agents in countries throughout the world and the Soviet head station in Moscow.
Okay. What are the key charges then? Let's get to your phrase, a species of espionage, which is a good one.
Well, there are many, many charges, and this is what Treasonable Doubt does, is address each of them. But largely, the charges of policy subversion were advanced by Elizabeth Bentley. She charged Harry Dexter White with doing all sorts of things, such as precipitating the fall of China in terms of manipulating the price of gold. But to look at her allegations in terms of the evidence that we have, I found at least that the action of Treasury officials in 1944 and 1945 could hardly have precipitated the fall of what was indeed a corrupt and a brutal regime in 1948, 1949. All in all, I found that the allegations of policy subversion against Harry Dexter White were totally, totally baseless. But nevertheless, there was a certain amount of truth in terms of the charges that he was involved in what today, at least, we would define as espionage.
Okay. Was he a communist?
No.
And you don't believe he was part of a communist conspiracy then?
No, he was not a communist. The Venona decrypts established that he was, quote, an influential friend of the Soviet Union. In the lexicon of Soviet intelligence, I would define him as a, quote, trusted individual.
Okay, good. And you don't believe that he leaked classified information vital
No.
to national security?
No.
Okay. Now, you write that the saga of Harry Dexter White transcends these basic questions, those I just asked, actually, that his story tells us much about politics and society of the New Deal and early Cold War eras. It's a great sentence. What does it mean?
What it means, basically, is that Treasonable Doubt provides a case study of Cold War espionage. It gives us insight in terms of how the American government operated in a time of crisis. It shows how politicians, even today, look to scapegoats for their own failings. They blame shortcomings in American policy on spies and, to a certain extent, on foreigners. It gives us insight into the internal workings of the FBI, the internal workings of the KGB, and also talk and address the issue of the nature of loyalty in general.
why, I guess this is a question that continually comes up when I discuss this with people, is why years later did congressional committees place so much emphasis, and I'm talking about the post-war period, looking back to the 30s now, on an individual's political past and their interest in communism?
Certainly a person's past reflected their role in and their perceived actions in terms of an international conspiracy. Much like today, with the Bush administration targeting Muslims, for example, as potential terrorists, there is a certain type of a profile. There is memberships of organizations, for example, that can be deemed as being subversive, and this reflects the notion of certain people being a security risk. And certainly what happened with the political past of these people who were discussed before congressional committees and all, thousands of these people were displaced from their jobs in government and in schools and the universities, and also in Hollywood, for example, with the Hollywood writers who were dismissed from their positions.
One last question here, and maybe I might ask you also about your latest project. Before we do that, you're known for having played a major role in declassifying the records of the House Un-American Activities Committee and forcing open the Hiss grand jury records. This is a significant contribution, but tell us what that was all about.
Well, the grand jury records for the Hiss case are really very important because historically grand jury materials have never been made available to the public. Even today, the grand jury records relating to the Lincoln assassination, the Burr conspiracy, remain closed. I did bring suit, a case known as Craig v. USA, that established the principle that historical significance alone can, under certain circumstances, result in the release of grand jury materials. And that's what I was able to do in the process of writing this book.
Did you do that on a personal level or, let's say, an individual professional level, or is this tied in some way with your work for the National Coalition?
Well, actually, in a way, it was tied in with my work on the National Coalition, but I went to a public citizen litigation group in Washington, explained what my situation was, and had the pro bono assistance of them. All in all, the legal battle that took about 9 years to do resulted in two cases, an appellate case, cost about $490,000. This is the amount of money that many historians don't have access to, myself included. But every once in a while, there is a key case that pro bono law firms are willing to move forward with, and I was very fortunate to be able to have their support and their help in winning the release of those grand jury materials.
Yeah, it was a major victory, too. But we hadn't planned on going in this direction, but in the 2 minutes we have left, tell us what you're going to do with Hiss.
Well, what I'm working on the Alger Hiss case right now, I'm not all that interested in terms of the Hiss case, per se. In fact, that's only going to be like one chapter out of a book that I envision is going to be 13 or 14 chapters. What I'm interested in is looking very critically at the man. What made him do what he did? What made him a key player in the New Deal? What actions and activities did he take as a high-ranking official in the Roosevelt administration? And particularly of interest to me is how did the man deal with his life after the conviction of perjury, after he no longer held the position of high authority? And how did he manage to reconcile his beliefs as a young man with his actions as an older man?
Are there new documents involved in this book as well, or are you just sort of re-examining what has already been made public?
Well, I'm going to re-examine what certainly has been made public and integrate some of the biographies that have come out recently. But I'm also trying to get access to some of the Hiss-specific related materials in the Soviet archives, which is a little bit more difficult. But I do think that that type of information is going to be made available. Also, I'm trying to get some additional material out of the Venona decrypts that I think will be important in terms of looking at this particular case.
Being an Americanist, I don't know the answer to this, but how do you access the Russian archives?
It's done through contacts.
Okay.
And to a certain extent, it's done through laying out silver coins in people's hands.
Straightforward answer. I like that one. Okay. Well, thanks for being with us, and I hope you'll come back when you finish your Hiss book.
Thank you, Brian.
Great. You've been listening to Bruce Craig, author of Treasonable Doubt, The Harry Dexter White Spy Case, published by the University Press of Kansas.